everyone, welcome back to Project Unlaced. Today, I'm super excited to talk to my guest. We have Alisa Lieb. She is a registered dietitian and very passionate about mountain sports. So thank you so much for joining me today. How are you doing?
Yeah, thanks so much for inviting me here to talk. I'm doing really well today. I'm very excited for the weekend.
Yes. So I'd love to start out our conversation with some background information about yourself. So one of the things that stood out to me is that you describe yourself as an anti-diet dietitian. Can you share a little bit about like what that means and how you came to that place? Because I know that isn't exactly the most popular type of dietitian right now.
Yeah, so I was thinking about how to sort of describe this in a concise way. And I think the reality is anti-diet is sort of a concise term that describes a lot of different sort of related things. And so I can kind of do my best to sort of explain what I mean by all of that. But I think in short, anti-diet basically just means that I reject diet culture and I promote size acceptance and holistic health as more important things than weight. So anti-diet is, you know, very closely related to the health at every size movement. Are you familiar with that?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Cool. I was going to say, I'm happy to talk more about that if that feels helpful. But yeah, health at every size. And then as well as the practice of intuitive eating is kind of tied in. With mm-hmm. When I say anti-diet, I'm actually really talking about all of these other things that are related. But, you know, I think the reality is like diets and diet culture cause harm and a lot of it. Depending on what research you look at, you can see anywhere between about 80% and 95% of diets fail, which means that people eat. Don't lose weight or they lose weight but end up regaining it. And in a lot of cases, the weight that they regain actually ends up being more than they had lost in the first place. And often what happens is when people go on diets, they lose weight, they regain it, and then they go on another diet. And so they end up in this situation of sort of yo-yo dieting or weight cycling, which is something that we also know through research is not good for you. This is something that can wreak havoc on your metabolism. It increases risk of type 2 diabetes, metabolic syndrome, cardiovascular disease. So it's not good for us. It doesn't work. And we also know that something like 20% of people who go on a diet actually go on to develop disordered eating or an eating disorder. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the kind of overview of why I am anti-diet. If it's not working and it's causing a lot of harm, it isn't something that I really want to be promoting. So being an anti-diet sports dietitian specifically, what this means is, you know, I end up working with athletes to improve health, which we can do independently of changes in weight. Obviously, as a sports dietitian, there's a lot of focus on performance here. And I know we're going to get into a lot more of that conversation around like the role of weight in performance a little bit later. One thing I want to mention, though, is like being anti-diet doesn't mean that I'm anti-dieter or that I won't work with somebody who wants to lose weight. I think the reality is, you know, in today's society, a lot of people want to lose weight. And yeah. It's totally understandable to want to change the size or the shape of your body. And that's not something that I hold against anybody. But, you know, for me in my practice, what I do ask is that if you are somebody who does still want to lose weight, I just ask that you kind of agree to put that goal on the back burner, just because we know that working towards intentional weight loss, you know, interferes with your ability to tune into your body's natural hunger, fullness, satisfaction cues. And then, like I mentioned before, it can actually like get in the way of the pursuit of health and performance.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting that you talk about all the negative consequences of dieting and how it doesn't even, a lot of times doesn't even have benefits. And the fact that so many people still go towards that path of, I need to lose weight and I need to follow this diet and then this diet. And I just think that's so interesting that our society is still so like wrapped up in that idea that the only way to, you know, love your body is I need to lose weight so that I can change it. And I need to like use this diet. So I just love that like you really approach it from a rational perspective of like, hey, this is the data and this is what it shows us. And yeah, I just think that's really great. And I think more people should definitely look at that.
I think we're starting to see a shift, but weight as a metric of health is just so deeply ingrained in like all levels of our healthcare system. I worked in public health before I became a dietitian, and then my dietetics degree is actually like centered on the public health side of nutrition. And it was always so frustrating to me that, you know, when you're applying for research funding through like the federal government for anything related to nutrition, 99% of the funding is basically set aside for like obesity prevention measures, which is big air quotes because I have a lot of issues with the word obesity. I think it's like very stigmatizing. You know, and it's frustrating because we know that nutrition does so many incredible things for us, even if weight doesn't change at all. But it's, yeah, I think it's just so deeply ingrained in like every aspect of like not only our healthcare system and our public health system, but like our culture.
One experience that I had with this, and I will like always remember this, is every time we would have health class or have that talk in gym about, you know, healthy habits, it would always be, you know, we're going to eat healthy and make sure we get enough exercise to maintain or lose weight. And that was all that always came up as a reason why we should focus on exercise and nutrition. And I just thought that was interesting that even like seven-year-olds are getting this message already from people who are in power, from teachers and from, you know, their doctors telling them like, hey, this is your weight, like this is why we need to do these healthy habits for this specific number. And I think it's so easy to like grasp onto that number and make that number like more important than it really is. I know that like I suffered from an eating disorder, and that was a huge thing, is that my life became defined as what this number is, and I no longer saw myself as anything except that.
I mean, it's such a sad thing. Like, you know, they really get you at such a young age, and we're seeing the consequences of that. I mean, we're seeing third graders who are going on diets, which, you know, third graders should never have to worry about how big their bodies are. They should have to worry about like who they're gonna play with after school. Yeah, and it starts so early, and it's just so like deeply ingrained in everything. So yeah, I get it. I understand why people have that desire, because it's been drilled into our minds since a very young age.
Yeah, so now I'd love to transition into like your role as an athlete. So you've shared a lot about your passion for mountain sports, like trail running, climbing, and skiing. So I'd love to just understand like how that shaped your approach to nutrition, especially since you are very much involved in like sports dietitian.
Yeah, where to start with this? I guess I'm going to try my best to keep this sort of concise. So I grew up as a soccer player. Obviously, there's like running involved as part of that. And I like ran middle school track, but I didn't really get into running until college, which I really did because I had gained weight my freshman year of college, which like looking back on it now, I realized that was weight that I needed to gain as just part of my natural development. But at the time, again, because messaging and everything we just talked about, you know, I freaked out. I saw my body changing, and you know, everything that I had heard was, okay, well, I just need to exercise more and eat less, and I can undo that change. And it all, you know, kind of culminated in, I like quickly slid into disordered eating, then eventually like full blown eating disorder. And then it all kind of culminated into a bone stress injury that went diagnosed for many, many years and kept me out of running for about 5 years. It was a really, really hard time. A couple of years into that injury, I was still very much struggling with my relationship with food and my relationship with my body, but I ended up moving out to Colorado. I grew up on the East Coast. And once I got to Colorado, I really was able to lean into mountain sports like hiking, skiing, rock climbing, because those were ways that I could move my body that didn't flare up my foot injury, my bone stress injury. And, you know, and I think that being involved in those sports in some ways was actually really helpful for my recovery. I always kind of joke that like, we have no idea how many calories we burn while we're rock climbing, which, you know, makes it into an activity that you can do for the sake of the activity and not for the sake of burning calories. But, you know, as I kind of started to recover from both my injury and my eating disorder, I started to just become really aware of the kind of universally bad relationship with food that so many people in these mountain sports communities that I was a part of have. There's a lot of like lighter is better messaging, especially in the climbing world, but like I see it everywhere. And, you know, I think there, it can feel kind of like a badge of honor sometimes in these sports to say like, oh, well, you know, I went this long without eating and, you know, was still able to like climb harder, you know, climb these mountains or do all of these things. So interestingly, I'm going to kind of tie this in with like my practice of nutrition, but like it was actually my eating disorder that sort of led me to decide to go back to school to pursue a career in nutrition in the first place, which, side note, is unfortunately really, really common. dietetic students basically shows really high rates of disordered eating, because the idea is like we try to learn as much as we can about nutrition so that we can control our own diets and our own bodies. And I was one of those people. Mm-hmm. Incredibly grateful that I was able to recover from my eating disorder before I actually started my master's program in dietetics. So I was able to come into it from like a much clearer space. But yeah, as I was kind of going through this whole process of recovery and, you know, knowing that I was on this track to become a dietitian, it just became really clear to me that I think I was sort of most needed as a positive voice in these mountain sports communities that I was a part of, just to help other athletes avoid going down the same path that I had. Yeah, it was kind of like my own experience with an eating disorder and with REDS, you know, kind of combined with like, you know, my nutrition knowledge and training that sort of naturally led to this point where I was like, okay, like I gotta help people not do this.
Yeah, I love that you talk about like the role of sports in your eating disorder as well as recovery, because I relate to that so much, being an athlete for so long. And then on the one hand, my eating disorder using swimming and running as a way to burn calories and as a way to feel in control. But then at the same time, seeing exercise is something that I do want to do and as a way to appreciate my body. And it's like, that can be really hard, I think, for athletes to piece apart, like, what is the discipline versus, you know, what is disorder and when does it become like an unhealthy relationship with exercise. And I know that that's been actually something that, like, I struggled with in the last couple of weeks, is having to step away from running and go towards strength training, so that I still get the exercise piece of, like, I can do it for my mental health and I can do it because it makes me feel strong, but I don't have that compulsion anymore of always trying to check my watch and see how many calories I'm burning. So I just love that you bring that up and, like, yeah, see sports from like both perspectives.
Well, I think that's a really good point, because for, you know, folks who are struggling with an eating disorder who maybe don't have that athlete background, a lot of the time the relationship with exercise is a little bit more black and white. Mm-hmm. You know, often we see, okay, exercise is actually kind of a net negative because it really is used as like a tool for the disorder. But for athletes, that gets really messy really fast, because I think, you know, sport can kind of be both, right? Like, it's both mm-hmm. a tool for controlling your body and for controlling calories. And it's also, you know, in many cases, something that is a stress reliever and something that brings joy and community. And yeah, and so it is very hard to kind of tease apart those two things. And I think, you know, that's something I've been really pleased to see as someone who kind of like works in this space, is that there are a lot more, you know, eating disorder informed providers who really understand that aspect of the athletic identity. And so we're seeing even a lot of like inpatient eating disorder treatment facilities are like starting to open, you know, athlete focused tracks where, you know, there is, if they're, you know, if they're medically stable enough for it, like you're allowed to continue your sport and continue exercise, because we recognize that it's something you're going to continue to do. So we need to, you know, figure out a way to help make it more like overall positive.
Yeah. But
yeah. It's definitely a lot more complicated.
Yeah. And I'd love to go back to something you also mentioned with, you know, climbing being one of those sports where there's a lot of myths around being lighter means you're able to perform better. And I'm a pretty big runner, so I deal with a lot of the same comments and, yeah, thoughts around like weight. So I'd love to just go into that. I'm sure you see a lot of athletes who are under that impression. Like, how do you help them shift that mindset? And is there any advice you have?
Oh yeah, it's so hard. I mean, one thing I will say is often by the time an athlete gets to me, they're sort of ready to break away from that kind of paradigm. But you know, because for so many of us, like, you know, we've been doing sports for our entire lives, and you know, a lot of folks have really felt this pressure for a long time, so it can be really hard to like break out of that mindset. So, you know, if anybody listening identifies with that, I have so much empathy for you. I know how hard it is. You know, and like I mentioned, I do feel like this messaging is sort of starting to change, and we're starting to see a lot more calls for, you know, appropriate fueling and, you know, doing these things regardless of, you know, the size of your body, but it's obviously definitely still out there. So, you know, everyone is different, and I definitely take a different approach with every athlete, just kind of depending on what works for them. But one thing I love to share is I'm a big like science nerd. So I love to just share like, where do these things come from? And like, what's actually like, what do we see in the research? What do we see from the science? So I don't know if this is something you've heard as a runner, but I know when I first really got into running in college, there was this idea that for every pound that you lose, you can save, or you can shave 2 seconds off of your mile time. That was like,
I've heard variations of that.
Yeah. So what's fascinating is I looked up the study where this number came from, because it does come from a specific research study. And I think like hearing more about like what that study looked like can really help you understand why it's not actually like that good of information. So in this study, runners were asked to do a 12-minute time trial on a treadmill. So run as fast as they can, as far as they can for 12 minutes and see how far they went. And then they were basically asked to repeat that time trial when they were given different weighted vests that were sort of based on like a percentage of body weight. So you might like once and then come in 2 days later and run it with like, you know, 10% of your body weight added to you. And then basically they averaged everything out. And what they found is that the runners were 1.4 seconds per mile slower for every extra pound that they ran with. So you can probably think of like some like issues with the way that this study was conducted.
Already when you said weighted vest, I was like interesting. Like when you change weight, like it's not just like a weighted vest that comes off of you.
Exactly. Yeah, your body like doesn't really work that way. Like if you gain weight, it's not like you just suddenly add weight, like your muscles and your tendons adapt. Like kind of the same thing if you're losing weight, it's not like, oh, I just, you know, I cut off a bunch of my hair and suddenly I'm much lighter. Like it doesn't work that way. If you're losing weight, it means you're eating in a calorie deficit, and that calorie deficit is like potentially causing damage to your muscles and your connective tissue and your bones. You're not, you know, able to access enough energy to actually perform in the same way. The other kind of interesting thing is I thought the 12-minute time trial was kind of interesting, because you know, the way that I've always heard this like 2 seconds per mile thing thrown around is that like if you're running a marathon, like that translates into all 26 of those miles, and that just is not how that works.
Yeah, I love that approach that you take, that you look at things like from a very rational perspective, and I think that's so helpful when these ideas are just like constantly around us, whether it's on social media, around friends, or even coaches. And to be able to like have that almost like power and say like, actually, no, like there's faults in like that quote unquote science that tells us that. I just think that's really powerful. And I think that it's important that young athletes like learn about these things, because obviously they get so many messages that tell them the opposite.
Yeah, I think especially, you know, in the era that we're in, where like, you know, there's great things about the internet. I'm going to say all of this at risk of sounding really, really old. But, you know, we live in an era where like everybody has a platform, and it's getting harder and harder to tell, you know, who is qualified to make certain things, and like what is actually based on fact or not. And yeah, so I think, you know, I find that a lot of athletes, kind of the reason they come to me is because they are looking to an expert to basically just say, hey, like this thing that you heard on Instagram is not actually legit, but this thing might be.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I see it all the time. And I think diet culture can just be so hard to catch on social media, because you're right, like everyone can make it sound like they're an expert and say, yeah, like, you know, I know a lot about this subject, or they use like, you know, they might post a what I eat in a day and have a body check at the start. And I think those are just things that like a lot of people would be like, yeah, like that's normal. But for me, who's been through that whole experience of having an eating disorder and really falling into the traps of those posts, like I see that and I'm like, okay, like that's when we scroll past, we block the account. So yeah, I just really like that you talk about the fact that it's so hard to piece like what's real and what's not.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had a thought there, and then that just like disappeared from my brain. What was I gonna say? You were talking about scrolling. Oh, the body checks. Okay, I remember. Yeah, I mean, you know, and I think most people share what they share with good intentions. You know, I can think of an account in particular that, you know, shares a lot of like body positivity stuff, but also like regularly posts what I eat in a day videos. And And, you know, and I think for this person, like, she thinks that it's helping, and I'm sure for a lot of people it is beneficial, but, you know, there's still that kind of aspect of, like, unknown harm in there. It is really tricky, and I think, you know, social media literacy is super important just for, like, yeah, protecting your own peace.
Agreed. Now, I'd love to go into, like, what are some of the early warning signs that an athlete might be underfueling, because you talked about how your injury went undiagnosed for so long, and I think that's one of the problems that so many people face, is that they have this problem, and it doesn't get recognized until some sort of a crisis point is reached. Like, in my case, I actually ended up in the hospital before I was diagnosed with an eating disorder. And I just think that's, like, so sad that it's not just me who goes through that. And there's so many other people who have to, like, suffer in silence, maybe not knowing exactly what's wrong, but knowing that something isn't right. So I'd love to just know, like, what are some small signs that an athlete might show before one of those crisis points is reached, like a bone injury?
Yeah. First of all, like, I'm so sorry that that was your experience. I'm glad that they eventually figured out what was going on and you were able to get the support you needed.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it was quite a difficult journey. I actually went to, like, my regular doctor's appointment a couple weeks before, and the doctor was, like, praising my weight loss, almost saying, like, how good I looked. And looking back, like, both me and my parents are just, like, astonished that that could have happened. And I think that just goes back to the fact that while there is more conversations about these issues, I don't think that there's enough conversation about these issues, and people actually aren't, like, educated enough to actually take action. Like, yeah, they might know about an eating disorder, but when they're faced with it, are they able to take action?
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, and I think that, again, that kind of gets, like, a little bit more muddled when we think about athletes too. You know, one thing that kind of comes to my mind as maybe, like, an early sign potentially, is a low resting heart rate. You know, and I think this is where I have heard from so many athletes, this was my own experience, of, you know, doctors praising a resting heart rate. Mm-hmm. And saying, oh, it's because you're so fit, it's because you're an athlete. But the reality is, like, a resting heart rate in the 30s is probably a sign of a sick heart, not an athletic one. And there's genetic anomalies, and, like, that's not the case for everybody. But yeah, I do think that just because the average healthcare provider is not trained to recognize these signs, it's something that often is praised more than anything else. Yeah, I think in general, like, identifying underfueling can be so tricky because a lot of these earlier signs and symptoms are really non-specific. So, like, there's a lot of different things that could contribute to them. You know, like, heart rate, yeah, like, it could be that you're fit, it could be that you're very sick. Another kind of obvious example of this is, like, fatigue. Mm-hmm. You're just really tired all the time. Like, I can think of about 20 things right now that could cause fatigue. So how do we actually decide if it's underfueling or not?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and a lot of athletes who are underfueling, they're going to notice multiple of these symptoms at the same time. Like, when we talk about relative energy deficiency in sport or REDS, it's a syndrome. It's literally just a group of symptoms that occur together. So that's, you know, always an important thing to look out for. If you just have fatigue on its own and you're like, hey, actually, I only sleep 4 hours a night, like, maybe you're not underfueling. Maybe you just really need to prioritize sleep a little bit more. But, you know, if you're fatigued, if you are not recovering well between your training sessions, if you're not performing as well as you would expect to, if your hair is falling out, if your stomach and your gut are acting up, if you find that, like, every time you turn around, you're getting, like, a small injury somewhere, like, these are all signs that, you know, there could be some underfueling going on. There could be something up. You know, and I think the unfortunate reality is that a lot of athletes don't realize that something is off until they get a stress fracture or they lose their period. And, you know, those are really kind of, like, late signs of underfueling. Your body has to be, you know, pretty undernourished before your bones start to break and before your body starts to, you know, shut down your hormonal and your menstrual function. So I always encourage athletes to just kind of be detectives. And, like, if you notice anything is off, start to get curious and see if there's, like, an obvious explanation for it and see if there's other things going on that could explain it.
Yeah. And I love that you talk about, like, the complexity of REDS, like, that there's so much gray area, especially with athletes. And I think you're right. That makes it so difficult for it to be diagnosed and for doctors to catch it. And I just love the fact that you tell athletes that, like, hey, it's important to like monitor your body and like what are the changes happening. And I think that's so important so that people do catch these things before, you know, bones break and periods go missing.
Yeah, I mean, in general, like my practice, a lot of it is kind of based around like our bodies are really smart. You know, we just kind of need to learn how to listen to them sometimes. So, you know, yes, we're going to use data and we're going to use metrics, but, you know, I'm constantly asking my clients, like, how's your energy? How are you recovering? How are you feeling? Like, what is your body trying to tell you? Do you feel hungry or full? Are you satisfied? Because the more practice we get with really listening to our body, the easier it is to notice when something is a little bit off, and the easier it may be to catch reds before it progresses a little too far.
Yeah. So at the start, we talked a little bit about like health and how society is so attached to this idea of weight being an indicator of health. And I'd love to just, you made a post about how we have actually less control over health than we think. And I love this idea because I think one of the reasons why I fell into an eating disorder is this like desire for control, whether that was, you know, my sports, school, my body. So I'd love for you to just like unpack that, because I think so many people underestimate how smart our bodies are and how much of that is actually out of our control.
Yeah, this is such a great question and such an important topic. And like, not to get too political, but I think it's just really, really relevant given all of the things that are currently going on in like the public health space. I'm going to put my public health hat on for a minute. When we think about all of the factors that influence our health, I think, especially in this world of like social media and everyone trying to make a buck, like we have this idea that our health is totally under control. Mm-hmm. If I eat right and I exercise well and I sleep and I, you know, am not stressed and I meditate and I go to therapy, like I will be fine. I'll be the healthiest person in the world. And the reality is we actually really don't have very much control over our health at all. So there's a model that kind of looks at these different like factors that contribute to health. And basically with this, I'll kind of talk through like what these factors are, so that you can sort of see what this percentage that we have control over actually is. About 20% of our health is determined by access to quality healthcare. So, you know, there's a certain extent to which we can control this. And I think this is especially true for folks who maybe just, you know, are a little bit more privileged, you know, have higher incomes, live in areas with good access to healthcare in general. Like, we can choose our doctors. But, you know, in the grand scheme of things, like the quality of healthcare that's available is probably more related to where you live and the economic resources that are available to you. You know, I grew up in a really rural part of Appalachia, and we had one hospital system within the area, and like that was kind of what we got. And you know, people who lived an hour and a half away had to drive into our hospital because they didn't have one. And so that's something where, you know, you can't, I mean, you can in some cases move, but that also isn't accessible to everybody. So that's about 20% of our health that we really don't have that much control over. 10% is going to be determined by our physical environment. So to give an example, if you live in an unsafe neighborhood and you don't have any sidewalks, the speed limit on your road is really fast, you're probably not going to spend a whole lot of time outside exercising. Mm-hmm. If your neighborhood is located in a place that has a lot of air pollution, that's going to take a toll on your health. So again, these are things that if you have the privilege and the ability to move somewhere else, you could make the argument that you do have control over this. But again, this all kind of comes back to like, well, how able are you to do that? So I guess kind of like what both of those things are alluding to is this next piece, which is, which represents about 40% of our health. And this would be a combo of both genetics and socioeconomic factors. So things like, what's your highest level of education? What kind of job do you have? How much money do you make? Do you have support from your family or from your community? You know, are you able to access childcare so that someone can watch your kids so that you can go exercise? Do you have time? excuse me. Do you have time to like cook your meals from scratch and eat a lot of fresh produce? Mm-hmm. These are things called social determinants of health. And again, they're not really things that we have a whole lot of control over. I think, you know, this category is probably the one where I would argue we have the least control over it, especially as far as like, genetics are concerned. So
yeah, I love
go ahead.
I love that, like, when I'm thinking about this, I'm really thinking about like social media influencers and how they like portray themselves as like, yeah, I'm super healthy. I work out twice a day. I eat all this fresh food. And like seeing it through this lens now, it's like, that is such a privilege that so many people like don't even have access to. Like they don't have the time to, you know, work out twice a day or home cook every meal. And I think that really shows, like, I mean, these influencers are trying to make a dollar off of people who are saying like, oh yeah, I want to look like them, so I'm going to follow their routine. When in reality, like that's not going to work.
Yeah, 100%. And like, obviously I'm a dietitian. Like I care about making choices to improve your health. But I think we have to contextualize it. And you know, and it kind of works both ways, right? Like on the one hand, you know, this belief that we have all of this control over our health leads to a lot of these disordered behaviors because we are, you know, so rigid and disciplined about it. Related to that, I think it can also lead to a lot of anxiety when our health maybe isn't where we want it to be. A lot of just blaming of, well, you know, if this is my fault that I'm sick or that I'm injured. And in some cases, you know, we like do know that, you know, for example, eating fiber is one of the best things you can do to prevent colon cancer. And so in some cases, if you go through your entire life and don't eat any fiber and then you get colon cancer, like there was something that you could have done to prevent that. But if you have a family history of colon cancer, do we know that eating fiber would have prevented it altogether? Not really. And, you know, and I think that's kind of the important context of it is that, you know, the amount of our health that is those behaviors that we actually have control over, that's only about 30% of our health. So it's not nothing, like it makes a difference, but it's not, you know, it's not the end all be all that these social media influencers would want us to think.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting. And I think that's just such an important point to put on, because I think so many people do feel like stigmatized or like feel shame because they feel like, you know, I'm not quote unquote healthy, so I'm not doing the right things. And I don't know, I just think that really helps like break that down and say, well, actually, like you don't have as much control over it as you think you do.
Yeah, I think in some cases it can kind of be a comfort, right? Like, you know, okay, you're doing your best, but you don't have to do 100% because there are so many of these things that are out of your control. You know, I talk a lot about like the 80-20 rule, and you know, I think there's a lot to be said for that. Like, yes, I want you to eat vegetables and I want you to eat protein and whole grains and fruit and, you know, all of these things that are really nutrient dense, but I also don't want you to be afraid of eating a donut because that donut is such a small percentage of your overall diet, which is then such a small percentage of your overall health. Like, go enjoy the donut. You know, it's less healthy to be afraid of eating that donut than it is to just eat it and be able to move on.
Yeah, that is a perfect transition. So speaking of the donut, I think processed foods gets a huge like bad reputation. And I felt this so much in my journey and also as I've, you know, obviously interacted with my teammates and my classmates at school of like sorting foods into good and bad categories. And often the processed foods end up in the bad categories. So I'd love to like know from your perspective, like why you think it's okay and often sometimes it's important for athletes to include processed foods in their fueling.
This is a big one because I know this has been very like front and center in public health conversations this year. You know, I guess the place to start with this is that there are a lot of misconceptions around what processed foods even are. You know, I think all of us can kind of recognize that like the donut is quote unquote processed, but you know, where do we draw the line with like frozen vegetables or, you know, hummus? The kind of like system that we have to talk about this is called the NOVA classification. It was designed by, I think it was this Brazilian researcher who basically figured out this system to put foods into these four different categories. So kind of, there's like more nuance to this, but like the short of it is that like level one is essentially like our whole food. So like fruits, vegetables, meat. There can be some like very light processing with this. So for example, like when you buy a like jar of like dried basil, that's still considered level one food because really all they've done to it is just dehydrated it. It's still, you know, got all of the stuff that like a fresh basil leaf would have. Mm-hmm. Level two foods are going to be things that are used to season or preserve foods. So these would be things like salt and sugar, or like oil, where they're not really foods on their own per se, but those are things that we can add to those level one foods and, you know, increase shelf life and those kinds of things. And that's essentially what our level three, which are just processed foods, are. They're basically combos of those level one and level two foods. So that would be like frozen potato wedges that have some salt and oil on them. That would be like a level three food. And then level four, these are our ultra processed foods. And these are the ones that I think, you know, are sort of the result of so much like demonization. So in theory, these are foods that have gone through so much processing that they don't really resemble the original level one food anymore, which sounds really scary. But if you actually look into like examples of what falls into each category, I think some of these would probably surprise you. You know, I think, like I said, no one's surprised to hear that like the donut or like the Reese's cup would fall into that ultra processed category. But actually, like a lot of brands of store-bought hummus are considered ultra processed. Even some brands of canned beans are, just because of the like types of preservatives that they add. And I bring up those things because I think, you know, hummus is often kind of viewed as like a health food, and, you know, beans we kind of view as this like unprocessed whole kind of plant protein. So like all that to say, it's very much not this black and white, like processed foods bad, whole foods good kind of thing. And then, yeah, to your point, like there's very much a time and a place for these processed foods. And I include those level four ultra processed foods in here, especially for athletes. Yeah, I think, you know, some of the like main benefits, number one, they're convenient. So I think especially as an athlete, this is important. The most important thing you can do nutritionally as an athlete is eat enough. Like we know, you know, at the center of REDS is low energy availability. So not eating enough. And athletes are also really busy, especially student athletes who have school and a social life and a job and practice and all of these things. Like if you have to make all of your food from scratch, you're not going to eat enough. Like you're probably not going to be able to. And so foods are so helpful to just make sure that you're meeting your needs, whether it's like adding frozen broccoli to your dinner so that you don't have to spend time chopping, or putting a protein bar in your bag so that you can get that recovery snack in after practice. Like convenience goes such a long way.
Yeah, I mean, I totally relate to that. Being a student athlete, it's so difficult to like actually eat enough snacks, like to get enough in. Like my parents always say, like, you cannot eat enough apples and carrots to fuel like a 6 mile run. Like that is, you're not going to be able to do that. And I think that's just so important of like, I think we need to start shifting our focus sometimes away from like exactly what are you eating, and like, okay, like as we just talked about, like that actually is such a small part of like your overall health. Like if you eat that protein bar, like that's such a small percentage of your overall diet. And then your overall diet is such a small percentage of, you know, your overall health and performance. So if anything, like that's going to help you to get in those extra calories and macronutrients.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's like very closely related to kind of the second benefit, which is that a lot of processed foods are really calorie dense. So yeah, to your point, like if you try to fuel your 6 mile run on broccoli, it's a lot of broccoli. Like that is so much broccoli. It's not going to happen. You're going to be, you know, running to the porta potty. It's not going to be a good time. You know, and this is another one of those kind of nuanced areas where the needs of athletes may be different than the needs of a sedentary person. For a, you know, sedentary person, do you need these calorie dense foods? Not necessarily. I mean, I still think, you know, they're allowed for everybody, but, you know, for an athlete, these can actually be the only way that you can actually meet your calorie needs that way. So again, still want you to eat that broccoli, but you know, I also want you to eat the gels and, you know, the banana bread or like whatever your like is to make sure that you are meeting your needs there. Yeah. You know, and I think the other thing I'll add to this, like processed foods are delicious, or they can be. And, you know, I've kind of talked a little bit about, you know, this idea of like not restricting what you're eating and just this kind of like 80-20 rule guideline. Food is fuel, but it's also a lot more than that. And when we think about our relationship with food, like restricting food is just, it ain't it. You know, all foods really have a place in an athlete's diet and everybody's diet. And it's, you know, it's totally valid to eat a food just because you like it. And so if anybody listening feels like they need that permission, I am giving that to you. You don't need to, you know, eat for nutritional value all the time. You can eat just because you want to.
Yeah, I love that so much. And I think that's been such, like, I've learned about that so much as I've gone through recovery, is that food is so much more than just, you know, something we need for our athletic performance or just for, like, general health. But, like, as I've opened up what I can eat and how much I can eat, like, I've been able to go to more social events. I've been able to connect more with people because I'm not so focused on the food. And I think that's just so important, is that, like, food is not just what, like, I think most of society wants us to think it is, which is, like, a way to control your health. But, like food is a way that we can, you know, be part of, like, culture and family and friends. And I think that's also just, like, a really important point. And that kind of goes into my next question of that. Like, diet culture often praises this discipline of, like, you have to eat healthy all the time. And we've talked a little bit about, like, that can be really harmful, especially for athletes. So I'd love to just unpack that is, like, our last question of, like, how is viewing nutrition as a test of willpower? How can that be harmful?
Yeah, I think you just said that really well, right? And I think one of the reasons that athletes in particular are so prone to disordered eating, eating disorders, REDS, all of the things is because of this discipline. I mean, it takes a lot of discipline to be an athlete, especially, you know, if you are, like, competing at a high level. And if you are disciplined about your training, it's really easy to think, okay, well, I'm going to be disciplined in my nutrition too. And if I do that, I will be the best that I can be. And so, you know, I think kind of similar to, like, our conversation around health, like, this is very much a message that we see that, you know, if we can just strictly control our diet, then, you know, we can change the way our body looks, or we can change the way that it performs. And, you know, again, like, there is a role of nutrition in performance, like, that definitely exists. But, you know, I think the discipline piece can be a little bit of a slippery slope. And that's especially true without support from knowledgeable nutrition or healthcare professional. Or, you know, I know a lot of what, like, Project Unlace seems to do is just sort of empower coaches to be able to, you know, be aware of some of these red flags and, like, you know, create a positive environment. You know, so I think in the absence of those kinds of, you know, mentors and professionals, add social media into that, and, you know, that high drive for success, I think, can be really detrimental. Yeah, I think I also see this come up a lot of the time as this idea of, like, well, I train so hard so that I can eat, like, I train to eat. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and, you know, I think, like, shifting away from this into kind of the opposite mindset of, like, eating so that you can train, so that you can perform, ultimately, you know, leads to more positive outcomes in terms of performance, physical health, mental health, relationship with food, all of those things. And I think that's kind of, like, the kind of base of all of this is that, like, you have to nourish your body in order for it to do cool things. Mm-hmm. And while, like, you may be able to get away with being undernourished for a short period of time. I mean, I talk with athletes all the time who are like, yeah, you know, the start of my eating disorder was great. I was putting down PRs. I got faster. I got stronger. Everything was great until it wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Eventually, yeah, it ends up.
Yeah. I think that's such an amazing, like, last message, is that, like, it is so important that we see food as more than fuel, but then that we also realize that we do not have to earn our food or our calories, and we need those calories to fuel our body. And I just love that you also bring up, like, that it could have short-term, that some people do see short-term benefits. And I think that also is another barrier to getting help, is that people see, like, well, if this is helping me, like, why would I change this? So yeah, I think that's, like, a great message, is, like, knowing that it does have long-term.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'll kind of, like, you know, tie this piece in here, you know, just in the interest of, like, you know, good messaging to kind of end everything. But, you know, if you're listening to this and you're kind of like, oh, you know, now I'm kind of questioning if, you know, if I'm, you know, really healthy in all of these ways, I promise, like, reach out for help. I promise that, you know, you deserve that help and that support. I think it's really common for athletes especially to have this mindset of, like, oh, well, like, I'm not sick enough, I don't actually need this support. And yeah, I mean, if you're even questioning it, reach out, because you do deserve that.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a beautiful message to end off today. So I want to thank you again so much for coming on.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, like I said, thanks so much for having me. This has been awesome.